faces in that bar. You should have seen them. They were so wise and tragic, and they knew that now they knew everything, that they had always known it, and they were so glad that they had never had anything to do with me. Ah, les cures, the dirty sons of bitches, les gonzesses. He was weeping again with rage, this time. Then, at last, I struck him. And then many hands grabbed me, and now I hardly know what happened, but by and by I was in the street, with all these torn bills in my hand and everybody staring at me. I did not know what to do. I hated to walk away, but I knew if anything more happened, the police would come and Guillaume would have me put in jail. But I will see him again, I swear it. And on that day, he stopped and sat down, staring at the wall. Then he turned to me. He watched me for a long time in silence. Then, "If you were not here," he said very slowly, "this would be the end of Giovanni." I stood up. "Don't be silly," I said. "It's not so tragic as all that." I paused. "Guillaume's disgusting. They all are. But it's not the worst thing that ever happened to you, is it?"
"Maybe everything bad that happens to you makes you weaker," says Giovanni, as though he had not heard me. "And so you can stand less and less." Then looking up at me, "No. The worst thing happened to me long ago. And my life has been awful since that day. You are not going to leave me, are you?" I laughed. "Of course not." I started shaking the broken glass off our blanket onto the floor. "I do not know what I would do if you left me." For the first time, I felt the suggestion of a threat in his voice. Or I put it there. "I have been alone so long. I do not think I would be able to live if I had to be alone again." "You aren't alone now," I said. And then quickly, for I could not at that moment have endured his touch, "Shall we go for a walk? Come, out of this room for a minute." I grinned and cuffed him roughly, football fashion, on the neck. Then we clung together for an instant. I pushed him away. "I'll buy you a drink," I said.
"And will you bring me home again?" he asked.
"Yes, I'll bring you home again.
Je t'aime, tu sais. Je le sais, mon vieux."
He went to the sink and started washing his face. He combed his hair. I watched him. He grinned at me in the mirror, looking suddenly beautiful and happy. And young. I had never in my life before felt so helpless or so old.
"But we will be all right," he cried, "n'est-ce pas?"
"Certainly," I said. He turned from the mirror. He was serious again. "But you know, I do not know how long it will be before I find another job. And we have almost no money. Do you have any money? Did any money come from New York for you today?" "No money came from New York today," I said calmly, "but I have a little money in my pocket." I took it all out and put it on the table. About 4,000 francs. "And I," he went through his pockets, scattering bills and change. He shrugged and smiled at me, that fantastically sweet and helpless and moving smile. "Je m'excuse." I went a little mad. He went down on his hands and knees and gathered it up and put it on the table beside the money I had placed there. About 3,000 francs worth of bills had to be pasted together, and we put those aside until later. The rest of the money on the table totaled about 9,000 francs.
"We are not rich," says Giovanni grimly.
but we will eat tomorrow. I somehow did not want him to be worried. I could not endure that look in his face. I'll write my father again tomorrow, I said. I'll tell him some kind of lie that he'll believe, and I'll make him send me some money. And I moved toward him as though I were driven, putting my hands on his shoulders and forcing myself to look into his eyes. I smiled, and I really felt at that moment that Judas and the Savior had met in me. Don't be frightened. Don't worry. And I also felt, standing so close to him, feeling such a passion to keep him from terror, that a decision, once again, had been taken from my hands. For neither my father nor Hella was real at that moment. And yet even this was not as real as my despairing sense that nothing was real for me, nothing would ever be real for me again. Unless, indeed, this sensation of falling was reality. The hours of this night begin to dwindle, and now, with every second that passes on the clock, the blood at the bottom of my heart begins to boil, to bubble, and I know that no matter what I do, anguish is about to overtake me in this house. As naked and silver as that great knife which Giovanni will be facing very soon. My executioners are here with me, walking up and down with me, washing things and packing and drinking from my bottle. They are everywhere I turn, walls, windows, mirrors, water. The night outside, they are everywhere. I might call, as Giovanni, at this moment, lying in his cell, might call, but no one will hear. I might try to explain. Giovanni tried to explain. I might ask to be forgiven. If I could name and face my crime, if there were anything or anybody anywhere with the power to forgive. No. It would help if I were able to feel guilty. But the end of innocence is also the end of guilt. No matter how it seems now, I must confess, I loved him. I do not think that I will ever love anyone like that again. And this might be a great relief if I did not also know that when the knife has fallen, Giovanni, if he feels anything, will feel relief. I walk up and down this house, up and down this house. I think of prison. Long ago, before I had ever met Giovanni, I met a man at a party at Jacques' house who was celebrated because he had spent half his life in prison. He had then written a book about it which displeased the prison authorities and won a literary prize. But this man's life was over. He was fond of saying that, since to be in prison was simply not to live. The death penalty was the only merciful verdict any jury could deliver. I remember thinking that, in effect, he had never left prison. Prison was all that was real to him. He could speak of nothing else. All his movements, even to the lighting of a cigarette, were stealthy. Wherever his eyes focused, one saw a wall rise up. His face, the color of his face, brought to mind darkness and dampness. I felt that if one cut him, his flesh would be the flesh of mushrooms. And he described to us in avid, nostalgic detail the barred windows, the barred doors, the Judas, the guards standing at far ends of corridors under the light. It is 3 tiers high inside the prison. And everything is the color of gunmetal. Everything is dark and cold, except for those patches of light where authority stands. There is on the air perpetually the memory of fists against the metal, a dull, booming tom-tom possibility, like the possibility of madness. The guards move and mutter and paced the corridors and boomed dully up and down the stairs. They are in black. They carry guns. They are always afraid. They scarcely dare be kind. 3 tiers down, in the prison's center, in the prison's great cold heart, there is always activity. Trusted prisoners wheeling things about, going in and out of the offices, ingratiating themselves with the guards for privileges of cigarettes, alcohol, and sex. The night deepens in the prison. There's muttering everywhere. And everybody knows, somehow, that death will be entering the prison courtyard early in the morning. Very early in the morning, before the trustees begin wheeling great garbage cans of food along the corridors, 3 men in black will come noiselessly down the corridor. One of them will turn the key in the lock. They will lay hands on someone and rush him down the corridor, first to the priest, and then to a door which will open only for him, which will allow him, perhaps, one glimpse of the morning before he is thrown forward on his belly on a board and the knife falls on his neck. I wonder about the size of Giovanni's cell. I wonder if it is bigger than his room. I know that it is colder. I wonder if he is alone, or with 2 or 3 others, if he is perhaps playing cards, or smoking, or talking, or writing a letter. To whom would he be writing a letter, or walking up and down? I wonder if he knows that the approaching morning is the last morning of his life. For the prisoner usually does not know. The lawyer knows and tells the family or friends, but does not tell the prisoner. I wonder if he cares. Whether he knows or not, cares or not, he is certainly afraid. Whether he is with others or not, he is certainly alone. I try to see him, his back to me, standing at the window of his cell. From where he is, perhaps he can only see the opposite wing of the prison. Perhaps by straining a little just over the high wall, a patch of the street outside. I do not know if his hair has been cut or is long. I should think it would have been cut. I wonder if he is shaven. And now a million details, proof and fruit of intimacy, flood my mind. I wonder, for example, if he feels the need to go to the bathroom, if he has been able to eat today, if he is sweating or dry. I wonder if anyone has made love to him in prison. And then something shakes me. I feel shaken hard and dry like some dead thing in the desert, and I know that I am hoping that Giovanni is being sheltered in someone's arms tonight. I wish that someone were here with me. I would make love to whoever was here all night long. I would labor with Giovanni all night long. Those days after Giovanni had lost his job, we dawdled. Dawdled as doomed mountain climbers may be said to dawdle above the chasm, held only by a snapping rope. I did not write my father. I put it off from day to day. It would have been too definitive an act. I knew which lie I would tell him, and I knew the lie would work. Only, I was not sure that it would be a lie. Day after day, we lingered in that room, and Giovanni began to work on it again. He had some weird idea that it would be nice to have a bookcase sunk in the wall. And he chipped through the wall until he came to the brick and began pounding away at the brick. It was hard work. It was insane work, but I did not have the energy or the heart to stop him. In a way, he was doing it for me, to prove his love for me. He wanted me to stay in the room with him. Perhaps he was trying, with his own strength, to push back the encroaching walls without, however, having the walls fall down. Now, of course, I see something very beautiful in those days, which were such torture then. I felt then that Giovanni was dragging me with him to the bottom of the sea. He could not find a job. I knew that he was not really looking for one, that he could not. He had been bruised, so to speak, so badly that the eyes of strangers lacerated him like salt. He could not endure being very far from me for very long. I was the only person on God's cold, green earth who cared about him, who knew his speech and silence, knew his arms, and did not carry a knife. The burden of his salvation seemed to be on me, and I could not endure it. And the money dwindled. It went, it did not dwindle very fast. Giovanni tried to keep panic out of his voice when he asked me each morning, "Are you going to American Express today?" "Certainly," I would answer. "Do you think your money will be there today?" "I don't know." "What are they doing with your money in New York?" Still, I could not act. I went to Jacques and borrowed 10,000 francs from him again. I told him that Giovanni and I were going through a difficult time, but that it would be over soon. "He was very nice about it," says Giovanni. "He can sometimes be a very nice man." We were sitting on a terrace near Odeon. I looked at Giovanni and thought for a moment how nice it would be if Jacques would take him off my hands. "What are you thinking?" asked Giovanni. For a moment I was frightened, and I was also ashamed. "I was thinking," I said, "that I'd like to get out of Paris."
"Where would you like to go?"
he asked. "Oh, I don't know. Anywhere. I'm sick of this city," I said suddenly with a violence that surprised us both. "I'm tired of this ancient pile of stone and all these goddamn smug people. Everything you put your hands on here comes to pieces in your hands." "That," said Giovanni gravely, "is true." He was watching me with a terrible intensity. I forced myself to look at him and smile. "Wouldn't you like to get out of here for a while?" I asked. "Ah," he said, and raised both hands briefly, palms outward in a kind of mock resignation. "I would like to go wherever you go. I do not feel so strongly about Paris as you do, suddenly. I have never liked Paris very much." "Perhaps," I said, I scarcely knew what I was saying, "we could go to the country, or to Spain." "Ah," he said lightly, "you are lonely for your mistress." I was guilty and irritated and full of love and pain. I wanted to kick him, and I wanted to take him in my arms. "That's no reason to go to Spain," I said sullenly. "I just like to see it, that's all. This city is expensive." "Well," he said brightly, "let us go to Spain. Perhaps it will remind me of Italy." "Would you rather go to Italy? Would you rather visit your home?" He smiled. "I do not think I have a home there anymore." And then, "No, I would not like to go to Italy. Perhaps, after all, for the same reason you do not want to go to the United States." "But I am going to the United States," I said quickly. And he looked at me. "I mean, I'm certainly going to go back there one of these days." "One of these days," he said. "Everything bad will happen one of these days." "Why is it bad?" He smiled. "Why, you will go home, and then you will find that home is not home anymore. Then you will really be in trouble. As long as you stay here, you can always think, one day I will go home." He played with my thumb and grinned. "N'est-ce pas?" "Beautiful logic," I said. You mean I have a home to go to as long as I don't go there? He laughed. Well, isn't it true? You don't have a home until you leave it, and then when you have left it, you never can go back. I seem, I said, to have heard this song before.
Ah, yes, said Giovanni, and you will certainly hear it again. It is one of those songs that somebody somewhere will always be singing.
We rose and started walking. And what would happen, I asked, idly, if I shut my ears? He was silent for a long while. Then,
you do sometimes remind me of the kind of man who is tempted to put himself in prison in order to avoid being hit by a car.
That, I said sharply, would seem to apply much more to you than to me.
What do you mean? He asked.
I'm talking about that room, that hideous room. Why have you buried yourself there so long?
Buried myself?
Forgive me, mon cher Mercain, but Paris is not like New York. It is not full of palaces for boys like me. Do you think I should be living in Versailles instead?
There must,
I said, be other rooms.
Ça ne manque pas, le chum. The world is full of rooms. Big rooms, little rooms, round rooms, square rooms, rooms high up, rooms low down. All kinds of rooms. What kind of room do you think Giovanni should be living in? How long do you think it took me to find the room I have? And since when? Since when? He stopped and beat with his forefinger on my chest. Have you so hated the room? Since when? Since yesterday? Since always? Dis-moi.
Facing him, I faltered. I don't hate it. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. His hands dropped to his sides. His eyes grew big. He laughed.
Hurt my feelings? Am I now a stranger that you speak to me like that with such an American politeness?
All I mean, baby, is that I wish we could move.
We can move? Tomorrow. Let us go to a hotel. Is that what you want? Le Crayon, peut-être?
I sighed, speechless, and we started walking again.
I know, he burst out after a moment. I know. You want to leave Paris. You want to leave the room. Ah! You are wicked, comme tu es méchant.
You misunderstand me, I said. You misunderstand me. He smiled grimly to himself.
J'espère bien.
Later, when we were back in the room, putting the loose bricks Giovanni had taken out of the wall into a sack, he asked me,
this girl of yours, have you heard from her lately?
Not lately, I said. I did not look up. But I expect her to turn up in Paris almost any day now. He stood up, standing in the center of the room under the light, looking at me. I stood up too, half smiling, but also in some strange, dim way, a little frightened.
Viens, m'embrasser, he said.
I was vividly aware that he held a brick in his hand. I held a brick in mine. It really seemed for an instant that if I did not go to him, we would use these bricks to beat each other to death. Yet I could not move at once. We stared at each other across a narrow space that was full of danger, that almost seemed to roar like flame.
Come, he said.
I dropped my brick and went to him. In a moment, I heard his fall. And at moments like this, I felt that we were merely enduring and committing the longer and lesser and more perpetual murder.
4. At last there came the note which I had been waiting
from Hella, telling me what day and hour she would arrive in Paris. I did not tell this to Giovanni, but walked out alone that day and went to the station to meet her. I had hoped that when I saw her, something instantaneous, definitive, would have happened in me, something to make me know where I should be and where I was. But nothing happened. I recognized her at once before she saw me. She was wearing green, her hair was a little shorter, and her face was tan, and she wore the same brilliant smile. I loved her as much as ever, and I still did not know how much that was. When she saw me, she stood stock still on the platform, her hands clasped in front of her, with her wide-legged, boyish stance, smiling. For a moment, we simply stared at each other. Eh bien, she said, ton bras passe de femme? Then I took her in my arms, and something happened then. I was terribly glad to see her. It really seemed, with Hella in the circle of my arms, that my arms were home, and I was welcoming her back there. She fitted in my arms. She always had. And the shock of holding her caused me to feel that my arms had been empty since she had been away. I held her very close in that high, dark shed, with a great confusion of people all about us, just beside the breathing train. She smelled of the wind and the sea and of space, and I felt in her marvelously living body the possibility of legitimate surrender. Then she pulled away. Her eyes were damp. Let me look at you, she said. She held me at arm's length, searching my face. Ah, you look wonderful. I'm so happy to see you again. I kissed her lightly on the nose and felt that I had passed the first inspection. I picked up her bags and we started towards the exit. Did you have a good trip? And how was Seville? And how do you like bullfights? Did you meet any bullfighters? Tell me everything. She laughed. Everything is a very tall order. I had a terrible trip. I hate trains. I wish I'd flown, but I've been in one Spanish airplane and I swore never, never again. It rattled, my dear, in the middle of the air just like a Model T Ford. It had probably been a Model T Ford at one time, and I just sat there praying and drinking brandy. I was sure I'd never see land again. We passed through the barrier into the streets. Hella looked about delightedly at all of it, the cafes, the self-contained people, the violent snarl of the traffic, the blue-caped traffic policeman and his white gleaming club. Coming back to Paris, she said after a moment, is always so lovely, no matter where you've been. We got into a cab, and our driver made a wide, reckless circle into the stream of traffic. I should think that even if you returned here in some awful sorrow, you might find it possible here to begin to be reconciled. Let's hope, I said, that we never have to put Paris to that test. Her smile was at once bright and melancholy. Let's hope. Then she suddenly took my face between her hands and kissed me. There was a great question in her eyes, and I knew that she burned to have this question answered at once. But I could not do it yet. I held her close and kissed her, closing my eyes. Everything was as it had been between us, and at the same time, everything was different. I told myself I would not think about Giovanni yet. I would not worry about him yet. For tonight, anyway, Hella and I should be together with nothing to divide us. Still, I knew very well that this was not really possible. He had already divided us. I tried not to think of him sitting alone in that room, wondering why I stayed away so long. Then we were sitting together in Hella's room on the Rue de Tournon, sampling Fundador. "It's much too sweet," I said. "Is this what they drink in Spain?" "I never saw any Spaniards drinking it," she said, and laughed. "They drink wine. I drank gin fizz. In Spain, I somehow had the feeling that it was healthy." And she laughed again. I kept kissing her and holding her, trying to find my way in her again, as though she were a familiar, darkened room in which I fumbled to find the light. And with my kisses, I was trying also to delay the moment which would commit me to her, or fail to commit me to her. But I think she felt that the indefinitive constraint between us was of her doing, and all on her side. She was remembering that I had written her less and less often while she had been away. In Spain, until near the end, this had probably not worried her. Not until she herself had come to a decision did she begin to be afraid that I might also have arrived at a decision opposite to hers. Perhaps she had kept me dangling too long. She was by nature forthright and impatient. She suffered when things were not clear. Yet she forced herself to wait for some word or sign from me, and held the reins of her strong desire tightly in her hands. I wanted to force her to relinquish reins. Somehow, I would be tongue-tied until I took her again. I hoped to burn out, through Hella, my image of Giovanni and the reality of his touch. I hoped to drive out fire with fire. Yet my sense of what I was doing made me double-minded. And at last she asked me, with a smile, "Have I been away too long?" "I don't know," I said. "It's been a long time." "It was a very lonely time," she said unexpectedly. She turned slightly away from me, lying on her side, looking toward the window. I felt so aimless, like a tennis ball bouncing, bouncing. I began to wonder where I'd land. I began to feel that I'd somewhere missed the boat. She looked at me. "You know the boat I'm talking about. They make movies about it where I come from. It's the boat that, when you miss it, it's a boat. But when it comes in, it's a ship." I watched her face. It was stiller than I had ever known it to be before. "Didn't you like Spain?" I asked nervously. "At all?" She ran one hand impatiently through her hair. "Oh, of course I liked Spain. Why not? It's very beautiful. I just didn't know what I was doing there. And I'm beginning to be tired of being in places for no particular reason." I lit a cigarette and smiled. "But you went to Spain to get away from me, remember?" She smiled and stroked my cheek. "I haven't been very nice to you, have I?" "You've been very honest." I stood up and walked a little away from her. "Did you get much thinking done, Hella?" "I told you in my letter. Don't you remember?" For a moment, everything seemed perfectly still. Even the faint street noises died. I had my back to her, but I felt her eyes. I felt her waiting. Everything seemed to be waiting. "I wasn't sure about that letter," I was thinking. "Perhaps I can get out of it without having to tell her anything." "You were so sort of offhand. I couldn't be sure whether you were glad or sorry to be throwing in with me." "Oh," she said. "But we've always been offhand.
It's the only way I could have said it. I was afraid of embarrassing you. Don't you understand that?
What I wanted to suggest was that she was taking me out of desperation, less because she wanted me than because I was there. But I could not say it. I sensed that, though it might be true, she no longer knew it.
But perhaps, she said carefully, you feel differently now. Please say so if you do.
She waited for my answer for a moment. Then,
you know, I'm not really the emancipated girl I try to be at all. I guess I just want a man to come home to me every night. I want to be able to sleep with a man without being afraid he's going to knock me up. Hell, I want to be knocked up. I want to start having babies. In a way, it's really all I'm good for.
There was silence again.
Is that what you want?
Yes, I said. I've always wanted that. I turned to face her very quickly, or as though strong hands on my shoulders had turned me around. The room was darkening. She lay on the bed watching me, her mouth slightly open, and her eyes like lights. I was terribly aware of her body and of mine. I walked over to her and put my head on her breast. I wanted to lie there, hidden and still. But then, deep within, I felt her moving, rushing to open the gates of her strong, walled city and let the King of Glory come in.
Dear Dad, I wrote, I won't keep any secrets from you anymore. I found a girl, and I want to marry her, and it wasn't that I was keeping secrets from you, I just wasn't sure she wanted to marry me. But she's finally agreed to risk it, poor soft-headed thing that she is, and we're planning to tie the knot while we're still over here and make our way home by easy stages. She's not French, in case you're worried. I know you don't dislike the French, it's just that you don't think they have our virtues. I might add, they don't. Anyway, Hella, her name is Hella Lincoln. She comes from Minneapolis. Her father and mother still live there. He's a corporation lawyer. She's just the little woman. Hella would like us to honeymoon here, and it goes without saying that I like anything she likes. So, now will you send your loving son some of his hard-earned money? Tout de suite? That's French for pronto. Hella, the photo doesn't really do her justice, came over here a couple of years ago to study painting. Then she discovered she wasn't a painter, and just about the time she was ready to throw herself into the Seine, we met. And the rest, as they say, is history. I know you'll love her, Dad, and she'll love you. She's already made me a very happy man. Hella and Giovanni met by accident, after Hella had been in Paris for 3 days. During those 3 days, I had not seen him, and I had not mentioned his name. We had been wandering about the city all day, and all day Hella had been full of a subject which I had never heard her discuss at such length before. Women. She claimed it was hard to be one. I don't see what's so hard about being a woman. At least, not as long as she's got a man. That's just it, said she. Hasn't it ever struck you that that's a sort of humiliating necessity? Oh, please, I said. It never seemed to humiliate any of the women I knew.
Well, she said, I'm sure you never thought about any of them in that way.
I certainly didn't. I hope they didn't either.
And why are you? What's your beef?
I've got no beef, she said. She hummed,
low in her throat, a kind of playful Mozart tune. I've got no beef at all, but it does seem, well, difficult to be at the mercy of some gross, unshaven stranger before you can begin to be yourself. I don't know if I like that, I said. Since when have I been gross? Or a stranger? It may be true that I need a shave, but that's your fault. I haven't been able to tear myself away from you. And I grinned and kissed her. Well, she said, you may not be a stranger now, but you were once, and I'm sure you will be again. Many times. If it comes to that, I said, so will you be for me. She looked at me with a quick, bright smile. Will I? Then, but what I mean about being a woman is, we might get married now, and stay married for 50 years, and I might be a stranger to you every instant of that time, and you might never know it. But if I were a stranger, you would know it? For a woman, she said, I think a man is always a stranger. And there's something awful about being at the mercy of a stranger. But men are at the mercy of women, too. Have you never thought of that?
Ah,
she said. Men may be at the mercy of women. I think men like that idea. It strokes the misogynist in them. But if a particular man is ever at the mercy of a particular woman, why, he's somehow stopped being a man. And the lady, then, is more neatly trapped than ever. You mean I can't be at your mercy, but you can be at mine? I laughed. I'd like to see you at anybody's mercy, Hella. You may laugh, she said humorously, but there is something in what I say. I began to realize it in Spain, that I wasn't free, that I couldn't be free until I was attached. No, committed to someone. To someone? Not something? She was silent. I don't know, she said at last, but I'm beginning to think that women get attached to something really by default. They'd give it up if they could, any time, for a man. Of course, they can't admit this, and neither can most of them let go of what they have, but I think it kills them. Perhaps I only mean, she added after a moment, that it would have killed me. What do you want, Ella? What have you got now that makes such a difference? She laughed. It isn't what I've got. It isn't even what I want. It's that you've got me. So now I can be your obedient and most loving servant. I felt cold. I shook my head in mock confusion. I don't know what you're talking about. Why, she said, I'm talking about my life. I've got you to take care of and feed and torment and trick and love. I've got you to put up with. From now on, I can have a wonderful time complaining about being a woman. But I won't be terrified that I'm not one. She looked at my face and laughed. Oh, I'll be doing other things, she cried. I won't stop being intelligent. I'll read and argue and think and all that, and I'll make a great point of not thinking your thoughts. And you'll be pleased because I'm sure the resulting confusion will cause you to see that I've only got a finite woman's mind, after all. And if God is good, you'll love me more and more and will be quite happy. She laughed again. Don't bother your head about it, sweetheart. Leave it to me. Her amusement was contagious, and I shook my head again, laughing with her. You're adorable, I said. I don't understand you at all. She laughed again. There, she said, that's fine. We're both taking to it like ducks to water. We were passing a bookstore and she stopped. Can we go in for just a minute? She asked.
There's a book I'd like to get. Quite, she added as we entered the shop, a trivial book.
I watched her with amusement as she went over to speak to the woman who ran the shop. I wandered idly over to the farthest bookshelf where a man stood, his back to me, leafing through a magazine. As I stood beside him, he closed the magazine and put it down and turned. We recognized each other at once. It was Jacques.
Tiens, he cried. Here you are. We were beginning to think that you had gone back to America.
Me? I laughed.
No, I'm still in Paris. I've just been busy.
Then, with a terrible suspicion, I asked, Who's we?
Why, said Jacques with a hard, insistent smile, your baby. It seems you left him alone in that room, without any food, without any money, without even any cigarettes. He finally persuaded his concierge to allow him to put a phone call on his bill and called me. The poor boy sounded as though he would have put his head in the gas oven if, he laughed, he had had a gas oven.
We stared at each other. He deliberately said nothing. I did not know what to say.
I threw a few provisions in my car, said Jacques, and hurried out to get him. He thought we should drag the river for you, but I assured him that he did not know Americans as well as I, and that you had not drowned yourself. You had only disappeared in order to think. And I see that I was right. You have thought so much that now you must find what others have thought before you. One book, he said finally, that you can surely spare yourself the trouble of reading, is the Marquis de Sade.
Where is Giovanni now? I asked.
I finally remember the name of Hella's hotel, said Jacques. Giovanni said that you were more or less expecting her, and so I gave him the bright idea of calling you there. He has stepped out for an instant to do just that. He'll be along presently.
Hella had returned with her book. You two have met before, I said awkwardly. Hella, you remember Jacques? She remembered him, and also remembered that she disliked him. She smiled politely and held out her hand.
How are you?
Je suis ravi, mademoiselle, said Jacques.
He knew that Hella disliked him, and this amused him. And to corroborate her dislike, and also because at that moment he really hated me, he bowed low over her outstretched hand and became, in an instant, outrageously and offensively effeminate. I watched him as though I were watching an imminent disaster from many miles away. He turned playfully to me.
David has been hiding from us, he murmured. Now that you are back.
Oh? Said Hella, and moved closer to me, taking my hand.
That was very naughty of him. I'd never have allowed it, if I'd known we were hiding, she grinned. But then, he never tells me anything.
Jacques looked at her.
No doubt, he said, he finds more fascinating topics when you are together than why he hides from old friends.
I felt a great need to get out of there before Giovanni arrived. We haven't eaten supper yet, I said, trying to smile. Perhaps we can meet you later? I knew that my smile was begging him to be kind to me. But at that moment, the tiny bell, which announced every entry into the shop, rang. And Jacques said,
Ah, here is Giovanni.
And indeed, I felt him behind me. Standing stock still, staring, and felt in Hella's clasp, in her entire body, a kind of wild shrinking, and not all of her composure kept this from showing in her face. When Giovanni spoke, his voice was thick with fury and relief and unshed tears.
Where have you been? He cried.
I thought you were dead. I thought you had been knocked down by a car, thrown into the river. What have you been doing all these days? I was able, oddly enough, to smile, and I was astonished at my calm. Giovanni, I said, I want you to meet my fiancée, Mademoiselle Hella, Monsieur Giovanni. He had seen her before his outburst ended, and now he touched her hand with a still, astounded politeness and stared at her with black, steady eyes as though he had never seen a woman before. Enchanté, mademoiselle, he said, and his voice was dead and cold. He looked briefly at me, then back at Hella. For a moment, we, all four, stood there as though we were posing for a tableau.
Really, said Jacques, now that we are all together, I think we should have one drink together. A very short one, he said to Hella, cutting off her attempt at polite refusal and taking her arm. It's not every day.